Welcome to The New Exchange, a podcast series that explores how everyone has a story to tell. My name is Ken Grandpierre, and by the time you hear this episode, I'll be in France on a much-needed vacation. Two friends of mine are getting married, and luckily both my girlfriend and I were able to attend, but hey, enough of that. That's not what you're here for. You're here to be schooled on the magnificent talent that is Joel Culpepper. Take a listen to this. I'm not worthy, but I stuck around. Tears of a crown. Better man had come before me. Wanna pass it down. Tears. Pretty sick, right? What you just heard is a glimpse of the standout tune, Tears of a Crown, from his debut album, Sgt. Culpepper. The whole album is full of gems like that one, from songs like Poetic Justice and Black Boy. Joel is a British-based soul artist who's taken it upon himself to meld the smooth sounds of the 70s with our modern day, all while telling authentic stories that highlight the unique life that he's led. I'm talking about that ridiculously smooth R&B that never feels dated. Those moments when soul music is fused with funk and forces you to move in ways you didn't even know that you could. My favorite thing about Joel is how he's incapable of compromise. The truth of that is highly evident in his performances on Jules Holland and Colors, two experiences we chat about on today's episode. It's crazy, man. This album came out last year, and it truly feels like it came out just yesterday. Just know that while I'm in France, I'm truly jealous of all of you who'll get to hear this man's music for the first time. It's truly fucking special, and you're in for a treat. But for now, this is The New Exchange with Joel Culpepper. Enjoy. It's a pleasure to be finally getting to chat with you today, sir. How are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing good. It's a bit of a scorcher here in New York. My dog is on the floor looking at me like, why do I live here? But yeah, you know, can't complain, yeah?
Yeah. It's quite hot in London today as well. So.
Time of year. You know, I have to say, so my entryway into the world of Joel Culpepper was twofold, yeah? It was, I'm a big fan of Colors, and I was amazed by your performance. It was like really an unbelievable thing to watch. And then a couple months after that, I saw your performance on Jules Holland of Tears of a Crown. And that made me like dig deeper into your music. And I mean, that song specifically, Tears of a Crown, and how you performed it. I mean, you just brought it to life in a way that really made me go like, yo, who the fuck is this guy? That was like the reaction I had watching that. Man,
thank you. That means a lot. Thank you.
Yeah, that was so special. And I want to just like kind of sit on here for a bit, because when I consider that, right, when I think about Jules Holland, because I grew up on it a bit and it's been a big part of my life. And when I think about just the context of the UK, you know, apologies if this is in any way objectifying, but just tell me, how did it feel being a shirtless black man knowing you'd be shown across so many TVs across the UK? Because whether you were intending to or not, there is like a powerful statement within that in terms of embracing beauty and just embracing like of a black body, if that's, you know, a pretty
guess there was definitely a few questions around whether I should do that or not, and that wasn't necessarily from the BBC or Jules as such, because one of the things that I, you know, I'm a big fan of the show as well, and one of the things that I loved about watching it growing up was that it felt like they always catered and facilitated the artist presenting a space that you as the audience almost, I don't know, you got a sneak peek into their world. It wasn't about conforming to a sort of set thing that, say, Jules presents. It's about the opportunity for you to present your living room in your world, and that will look very different for different artists. And it's one of the things that kind of struck me about the show and its sort of relevance and its longevity, I think, is kind of intrinsic to keeping that element of the show quite prominent and allowing artists to do what they want to do within that 5-minute slot. And I think, you know, the sort of concerns were sort of in-house, and sort of my team sort of going, oh, you know, UK, this could go horribly wrong, right? And they were right in terms of raising those concerns and questions. But I think similar to Colours, I felt like, well, what would I do if this was a gig? And what would I do in terms of presenting me within this music and performance? And I just thought, yeah, I probably would be shirtless by now. so you know what? Let's do it. And, you know, there was definitely a bit of fear around it. But I think I just felt like, I need to be free and be as expressive as I possibly can. And I want people to feel and see the notes within my whole body, man. I just want it to be a visceral performance and you know, hold nothing back. So that was the sort of decider. But yeah.
I love how you put that there, because I did want to make it very clear that this performance is beyond just what I brought up, because like you even put it, there's like a beautiful physicality to the performance in terms of like the passion and the way you're singing that song. And you know, it's come up a few times in this series, but I think one of the things that really stuck out to me is how there are several ways in which the UK can feel kind of oppressive in terms of people expressing themselves. And I think what really struck me with that performance is that to see an artist like you do that was almost like seeing Neo in the Matrix, like the end of the first film when he like flies in the air. It's kind of like, oh, this is like happening here. Like,
oh man, that's amazing, because the Matrix is like, that's like one of my top films, man. So,
oh yeah,
I love the first one.
I was gonna say, I don't mind diverging a bit. Did you see the most recent one, the fourth one?
I did. It's gonna be a short review with me. Sorry, Keanu.
I was the same way. Like, this isn't giving anything away to people listening, but like, you know, when there's a point in a film where you kind of like mentally check out, for me, it was like the near the tail end where they had like a robot bird or whatever. I was like, yeah, I'm out.
Yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, we're sort of going off the subject here, but what, what was really kind of like, for me, I just thought I'm equally checking out, is that bit in the first bit of the Matrix, the first film,
yeah,
where he did kind of show you that physicality of, you know, swerving the bullets and whatnot. That was something that was almost, it was built up to that point, and there was a story around why that was so significant. And, you know, he's doing this cool move, but the cool move had context. Whereas this was like, we're just going to chuck cool moves at you.
Yeah.
And nostalgia at you as much as we can, and that's going to do it. And it's like, no, the story needs to do it, actually, and then the cool stuff needs to come after it if the story wants it to happen as well. So yeah, I guess in coming back to the gig and the performance, sorry, of that particular show, it's like, yeah, if it's just a shirtless person on stage and they're just flexing for its sake, it's kind of like, well, what's the point? But if it's about the performance and expression and conveying something, then the context is built around the story and people get it.
Yeah, exactly. I love how you brought that back around as well. You know, a reoccurring theme on this series is when I ask people, when did music enter your life? But considering how I first came across you and your art, I think I'd instead love to ask, when did performance come into your life? Because seeing what I saw in that, and what I've seen with just like clips of you performing online, it seems that that's such a big, important part of just your life.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess my earliest sort of memory is dance and, you know, winning. I never won anything, but I won like a dance, you know, like you have, I don't know what we'd call it in the States, but you'd have like, where you sort of muddled it. There's one chair that goes missing, and then
like musical chairs.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm being silly. almost like musical chairs, but there were no chairs. It was just, you just had to stay in and dance. And you know, this is like pre-10, and I remember I was just like in the last kind of like round of me and this other kid, there was a bunch of us, and all of a sudden I'm like in the last round with this kid, and someone picks me and says, I'm the winner. And that was my sort of first acknowledgement of, oh, I can dance.
Oh.
Well. And it's just been sort of linked to my journey in discovering music and singing and performance, sort of the bedrock being in church environments, being on a stage in dance troupes and stuff like that, that kind of gave me a bit of a taste of what it meant to be a performer and have a crowd and an audience, and you know, congregation was my first crowd and was my first stage to test what works and what doesn't. You soon realize what actually doesn't work as well quite early, because there's a lot of talent around and there's a lot of people that could do a lot of, you know, great things with their voice and just naturally rhythmic and great musicians. So it was quite a competitive environment as well. And I think I just sort of carried that with my sort of own musical journey and pursuit once I sort of stopped going in those environments and attached it to the music that I love, and it kind of stuck with me.
Yeah, I'd love to explore that a bit more, because, you know, for me, like, I love music. I've never, like, made music. I've never performed, but I have a big appreciation for it. And I, like, when I hear you say that, it made me wonder, like, what do you think it is about singing into a microphone that fills you up? Because whenever I see a performer, I feel like they're getting something out of the experience that they arguably can't get anywhere else. And it kind of sounds like that's what you were echoing there as well.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's a real high involved, I think. There's a real kind of, you know, you're transcending, you're kind of there, but you're hyper aware that something else is going on, and you're facilitating that energy in the room. And I think when you sing in a mic, you know, it's you're amplifying your voice and you are leading. Kind of definitely in a church context, you're helping and ushering people into a spiritual place and acknowledging their own sort of feelings and emotions. And I think you recognize the weight within that, and you know, there's so much joy that can come from when you get it right, when you start learning how to get it right as well. It's a real euphoric feeling. And I think I recognized at first it was quite fearful, because it's like, you know, 1, 2, whoa, everyone can hear me and I can hear me and I can hear everything that I hate about my voice. But once you sort of refine what it is that you like about what you do, and then you're able to let yourself go with that in your hand, it's a powerful tool.
That's so beautifully put. You know, I want to delve into your debut album, Sergeant Culpepper. And it has to be said, man, that you've been in the game for a minute, like since 2009, I think I read. And it took up until 2021 for us to get your debut project. So prior to me hearing it, I knew that, considering that was, like, you know, the story there, that it must have been due, from what I'm just kind of inferring from my experience of being with artists, that must have been due to how much quality you wanted the album to convey, and that you indeed needed to hear that within the songs. And I know it'll be a big task, but can you talk me through that, you know, that journey for you, that internal journey of what it took to get to that point?
Yeah, I think your assumption is right, in terms of, like, you know, wanting to get a body of work that felt really detailed and considered. But I think coupled with that, I was working through my own confidence in regards to, you know, being bold enough to put an LP out. I just always had this built up thing in my head in regards to what an album should do and what it actually means. And, you know, the records that I kind of define as an album are, you know, Songs in the Key of Life and Sign of the Times and everything in between. And it kind of felt like, you know, you're going to tell a story. You only get, not that you get one shot at a debut, but you want it to be something that can impact. And I think over time, it became more and more of a fear that I didn't know how to quite do that. And I didn't have the resources either. But it just sort of kind of started happening organically because of the relationships I was building whilst, you know, putting out little projects, EPs and stuff. It was setting the scene for the record, and a sort of pivotal person within that process was me meeting Swindle, who executive produced the album. We'd done Woman, which is the song I performed in Colors. And there was definitely this energy and synergy between us in regards to what we liked and what we felt in regards to, you know, the album approach and what that actually, you know, means. You know, our mentor would be a Quincy, and you know, how he went about making a record, or Berry Gordy and Smokey, and how they went about making, you know, their records from Hitsville. So it kind of, you know, our relationship started informing the music, and it started as well as performing live. And it built a structure for me to then start, okay, yeah, I'm just going to go in the studio with a few producers and that I know of from around, you know, doing this for a while, and get this tune and get that tune. And I subconsciously knew what I was doing. I just didn't want to completely put that pressure of album out in the ether. And, you know, I eventually let go of these sort of demos and sent it to Swindle and said, look, this is what I've been doing. And it was like, okay, cool. My job is completely different to what I thought it was going to be in regards to this record. You know, it's more overseeing. You've done a lot already. These songs are incredible. You know, we just need to make sure it all glues. Wow. And it's cohesive. So, you know, it was definitely a combination of just taking my time, wanting it to be detailed, wanting it to have a story, you know, the concept record, you know, the whole LP thing, but at the same time, getting out of my own head, having a bit of, you know, boldness and going, if I'm going to do it, actually, this is the only way I know how to do it, which is put my face on the front of this and own it. And it's the same with Colors. I didn't see any other way. It's kind of, with me, it's either 0 or 100. Yeah. And it's like, you know, go for it. If you're going to do it, then do it all in.
You know, what's so wild about that is, and I think it's what's kind of beautifully profound about the whole experience that you had. You're not necessarily describing an initial fear, but if you think about, like, from a music fan perspective, which you are as well, it's like, you think about these albums that you grew a passion for, and like the fact that you end up taking them with you at different stages of your life, it's almost like you find yourself revering them subconsciously. Like, just trying to like encapsulate the fact that a group of people made any David Bowie album, for example, is crazy. And then you think about your own art, and it's like, wait, I have to figure out how to do that or a fraction of that? It's crazy in what you said. And I imagine this must have been a big shock for you. You kind of found that accidentally in how you described that.
Yeah, I think I've watched a few documentaries, you know, music ones, and I kind of prided myself on, you know, imitating some of these guys that had built really solid relationships with different musicians, and, you know, them being friends and them sort of being in each other's lives in these really kind of significant ways. And I think what I'd done unintentionally is I'd created a real music bed to do a record that was pretty, that could turn a few heads because so-and-so is involved, or so-and-so is involved, or so-and-so is involved. And that was all kind of like, yeah, but I actually know them, and they, you know, we're good. It's not, there's no manager reaching out to a manager kind of situation. It's like, I'm like, oh, I'm doing something. Would you want to jump on it? And yeah, of course, you know, let's go, let's do it. So I think that was kind of the thing that I was doing, or I'd done, that really worked to my vibe, that I was just there. Those relationships were there to support making an album.
I love that you point that out. And it's worth noting that in the context of the music world, I think that's something that would surprise a lot of people, is that that's very I even hate saying it because it sounds so pessimistic, but it's not the norm in as much as it should be, at least in terms of just like how people tend to navigate. And there's a myriad of reasons as to why, but the fact that you're able to cultivate these relationships and have them actually be real relationships, like it's not, it's kind of like anti-networking, if you think about it, which I really love.
I mean, it's definitely, I feel quite privileged, you know, to have that. And, you know, in terms of like a sort of major label context and world, it's probably not the most efficient or the most, I don't know, you're not necessarily working with the hottest guy right now necessarily, or I don't know, there might be some sort of frowning on. But I really love the fact that, you know, everyone that worked on the record holds it with pride and is kind of like, it's Joel. You know, absolutely, I'm involved with it, yeah.
That's amazing. I want to start asking about some of your songs, because I love your song, Poetic Justice. And to me, it's a bit similar to Tears of a Crown, but also sounds wildly different. The similarity to me is how you're able to embody this soulful sound and sing from this place that to me felt very realized. Would I be right in thinking that you were singing the words as you were writing the song? That's kind of like the vibe I got across as I was listening to it.
Yeah, I think from how I recall writing that one, it was produced by Tom Misch, and he was coming up with some guitar chords. And I said to him, I've got these sort of chapters within this record, but I haven't got a bridge between one and the other. And I really need a tone and a sort of a space where I can sing something that's quite vulnerable. And he was playing his chords. And it's funny, you know, musicians, depending on who you're working with, you can talk in colors, you can talk in emotion, you can talk in, you know, other ways than saying, right, you know, this diminished chord, blah, blah, blah. You know, I've got no sort of musicality language in regards to that. But I said something, it's kind of like, I'm in a vulnerable space and I need to show the listener and people that are, you know, tuning into me that there's another layer happening in regards to my own thought process and my own journey in regards to what I'm talking about. And he just started playing these chords that for me was like, yeah, I know what I'm writing. I, you know, did kind of fall off the page. You know, the hook came first. I let in your love, that came in first. And then this idea of surrendering and being vulnerable again, almost allowing whatever pain or kind of experience, allowing that to kind of drift in and back out, and being vulnerable again to be open to love and all that it encompasses. And it felt very organic to get that song out. I don't remember it being that we did it in one session. It wasn't overly worked at all. It just kind of fell out.
That's amazing. And it's, again, you know, it's kind of beautiful you could have that experience within that in the context of songwriting. Like,
yeah,
it speaks to how it comes from a sense of feeling as well. And I think about a song like It's In Your Sex, like,
yeah,
man, how in the hell did you make a song that sound like, that's a song that sounds like something that my parents would listen to in the 70s, but it still sounds modern. Like, has anyone pointed that out to you?
Yeah, I've had this kind of like one foot in the the heritage, and, you know, honoring a lot of these soul artists and, you know, my love letter to soul, but kind of contemporizing it. And I think what's a contributing factor is the mix and master. So on a sonic level, you know, we went to somebody that wasn't kind of overly versed with soul music. They were more kind of in tune with dubstep and grime and Joker, who mixed and mastered the record, you know, kind of has this sort of weight and attack to hit what he does that I think a lot of soul records, I think we would naturally shy away from, because I think we'd feel like, oh, no, this is changing the sound a little bit too much. And I had a bit, I was one of them. I had a bit of a wobble during that whole process of going, this is hitting too hard. And, you know, it's not sounding like how I know those albums to sound like. And Joker was really, he held my hand through that, man, because he was like, the thing is that as great as those albums are, you're not in the 70s. And it's my job to help you translate this music today and for it to be accessible in various spaces, you know, whether it be your club, to your coffee shop, to the radio. That's where my ears are. And we need to approach it with this in mind. You know, we're not going to dilute anything. You've just got to trust me. And when he kind of framed it like that, it did allow me to kind of go, okay, so songs like It's Your Sex, I don't know, I felt like the approach was just, yeah, it felt different. And it felt like it was in hands that, like, okay, I get the reference. I know where you're going, but this is 2021. So this is what we're going to do to that.
Do you know, that's so crazy to me, because I got this vibe with the song and with what you just said. I feel like this, like, it'd be interesting to explore this with you. Would you say that with that in mind, this song almost kind of operated almost like a guiding light or a fixture in the context of the album? Because it does sound like the type of song that would have maybe revealed some things to you about where the album could go on a sonic level.
Definitely, because that, you know, The Senior Sex was actually one of the first songs I did for the record.
Oh, wow.
It was probably either the first or second song that was actually made, and I knew as soon as we started coming up with the melody and just the energy of it, I was like, this is for the album. They say it loud, but I was in my back of my head, I'm like, this is for the record. It informed a lot of the album, because I felt like it balanced very well between that 70s thing and, you know, the funk thing and the whole British thing, but at the same time, I don't know, it still felt quite fresh to me, and it felt quite new, and I kind of wanted to continue that energy within the rest of the record. And that was a real good sort of point to say, this is where that bite is. So yeah, that's interesting to say that.
That's amazing. I mean, that the odds of that is kind of mental, but yeah, I'm glad that ended up being the case. I have to be honest with you, I don't have a question about this song. I just wanted to mention that Return is so damn good, and it's a very addicting song as well.
Thank you, man. Yeah, love that tune.
Yeah, are there any songs, actually this just popped into my head in the context of just what we were talking about earlier, are there any songs off the album you haven't performed live yet, or have you had the chance to perform all of them in a live
concert? Yeah, so kind of similar to the record, we just wanted to present something live that felt intentional. And you know, when I've done shows and the time is allowed, you know, the album's just under, I think it's just over 40 odd minutes, so I perform the record from top to bottom in its order when I'm doing it live. And what's amazing, one, is that it flows still as a show in order, but two, you know, people really appreciate the fact that you're performing something that they know and that they've grown to, you know, grown a bit attached to. They know what song's coming next. They absolutely know that you're doing it in this order. And it's something that I saw, felt when I saw Stevie in Hyde Park, I think in 2016 maybe. He performed the songs in the key of life in order. Wow. And it was amazing. Like, obviously Stevie's amazing, but it was different in a way that I think, I don't know, everybody was just patient with, it wasn't just about, let's just do the hits and make sure that the show, it was like, let's go on a journey. And we all knew what that journey was. And I really took away something from that. And, you know, a conscious effort was made to perform the album in order.
Wow. That's just powerful. Like, honestly, it really is. Like, that's unbelievable. And it's really just, like, outstanding when you think about it. And, you know, after I listened to the album, I knew that I immediately needed to ask you about the closing track, Black Boy. And can you share with me the story behind the lyrics of this song?
Yeah.
It's a very special song, I have to say.
Thank you. So before sort of pursuing music full time, I was working in a school, and my role was a behavior mentor. So I would support the school and the staff with looking after the sort of vulnerable children across school. And their behavior often was quite challenging within the classroom. So it could be violent, it could be, you know, abusive verbally, you name it. Some of these kids were performing in these classrooms, man, they were going for it. So I was a buffer, and, you know, my job was to kind of build a relationship with that child that enabled or de-escalated, you know, these kind of intense confrontations that they might have with their teacher or another peer. And I could remove them from the class and, you know, calm them. And yeah, it was cool. And I learned a lot about myself, actually, more than I thought. So, you know, sometimes you think you're there to just provide something for someone else in those kind of jobs, but actually it's an exchange. And this particular lad, which Black Boy is the song is named after, he was definitely on everybody's radar because he had this kind of attitude, and, you know, he was always in trouble, but he also had a real charisma. And, you know, he's about 10 then, 10, 11, and a bunch of us teachers were sort of stood by the school gate, ushering in the kids that were late and arriving. And he came in, but he didn't just come in, like, he just kind of strutted in, man. And yeah, he had this hat on, like the doggy flap ear hat. He had his sister's pink lunchbox. He had a fur coat on, and he had no socks, and it was quite cold.
Okay.
And his trousers were just like swinging, you know, in, like, in the air, completely like carefree. I remember this kid hated wearing socks for some reason. Just didn't like the texture of the fabric, so he never wore socks. And we all looked at him. We all looked at him, and we just kind of mutually went, he's got it. He's absolutely got it. Like, you know, and you think at 10, you figured this whole life out, you know.
Yeah. There's only like a handful of people like that in your life you'll come across.
Right. And it was very, you know, there was some magic there. And even though I would often challenge a lot of the choices that he made, I was very keen not to quell that magic that he had. I saw it and I thought, I wonder if I had that in school, and somewhere down the line, you know, it kind of got quelled, it kind of got boxed in somehow. And it was just sort of trying to draw that comparison between he and I, and, you know, me celebrating this black lad, this black boy who was definitely, he was definitely a handful, but he was also, you know, a really charismatic person, and he needed celebrating by everyone universally. And I kind of wanted to dedicate a song to him and boys like him.
Because the world could use more of it. Like, that's, it's interesting. Yeah. It's a weird conundrum, isn't it? It's so special because there's so few people like that, but arguably the world would be a better place if there were more people.
I think we're so used to this kind of trauma porn and it being, you know, about, you know, especially within in the UK, it always feels like, in terms of, you know, telling a black boy's story, it has to kind of go down a certain beaten track. And I really wanted to present something that I felt like, I want to see white faces singing You Give Me Joy, Black Boy. I really want to put this in a space that is accessible, that I feel like we can all universally celebrate somebody. And part of this is the fact that he is a black man. And we're gonna state that from the jump, because his swagger, his attitude, his demeanor, his whole characteristics are weaved in his culture as a young African boy. And I kind of wanted to do something that was light, delicate, sweet, and just almost like irresistible to sing.
Well, that's so beautifully put. And it's interesting you say that in terms of the torture porn aspect, because I do think when I reflect on when I listen to the song, the imagery that was in my head was almost kind of like rays of light kind of creeping through cracks of concrete, if yes. That makes any sense.
The rose that grew from concrete, yes.
Yeah.
And he looked like Tupac. Like
no way.
He did. And I would always say to him, have you ever heard of a rapper from Tupac? And he kind of was yeah. I don't know if he actually did, but yeah. he had those kind of like Tupac's eyes. I don't know, the shape of his eyes were just really like, this kid really reminds me of Tupac. But
Jesus.
Yeah, I definitely felt elements of, if this was Tupac, how would you nurture this? How do you support this? How do you contribute to this talent without going, no, bad, whatever, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
He's expressing himself in ways that, you know, needs to be kind of just nurtured and steered rather than held and put down.
Yeah, and you know, with you saying that, I feel like something you would appreciate actually in this like just context of what we're discussing is, are you familiar with this show called Abbott Elementary?
No, I've recently, so weird you say that, because I saw it flash up on my Twitter, and I thought, oh, I've only seen like a short trail of it.
Yeah,
but I thought I think I would want to watch that.
I think what I'm about to tell you is going to make you want to watch it even more. So, I'll sell it to you and then tell you what I was going to say. I only started watching it recently and I really love it. It's a show that's essentially filmed like the way The Office is, the American Office, yeah. But in an inner city school, and it's a predominantly like black cast. So the creator is this woman, Quinita Benson, and she's black, obviously. And she's the lead on the show, and she's also the writer and producer. And there's just a lot of things pertaining to the culture that you could tell could only come from her pen. And it's really funny and very cutting. And there's loads of jokes in the show that you know white people aren't going to get. So it's wild that it's become this successful. The reason I brought it up to you is because we're recording this like in mid-June. This should be coming out later in the summer. And quite recently here in the States, we've had school shootings, which nobody's surprised about. And on social media, there was this outcry that they should make an episode of Abbott Elementary that has a school shooting as part of the plot. And prior to making the show, Quinita Benson was and is very popular on social media. So when this narrative started of like the desire, she immediately clapped back on people's social media like, hang on a second. I made a show with a show that's a predominantly like black school, black kids. You want me to make an episode about a school shooting? Are you people fucking crazy? No. Like, it's...
I can't wait to watch that. That's jumped right to the top of the list.
Yeah, yeah. And once you see the show, like when you think about her clapping back on people on Twitter, it very much matches up. So.
That's wicked.
Yeah, yeah. But before we wrap, and I have to say, I'm actually surprised I didn't ask you this right off the top. Because, it's kind of wild. I missed out on seeing you here with the fantastic man that is Tom Misch. I've seen him live a couple times, and him and his crew are really amazing people. You were here in New York doing a couple shows. Yeah. And I remember when I saw the bill, I was like, fuck. And while we're in the process of setting this up, you were in South America with him. And I mean, I've never been. I'd love to go. What was that like for you?
Yeah, South America, man. Wow. we had another hour. it's a beautiful place. I was completely in awe of their passion, their enthusiasm. Their... It felt like we was at the World Cup final every night, wherever we went. And it, wow. It's infectious. Their kind of way they celebrate artists and music. It's, you know, we could all take a leaf out of their book, specifically, you know, visiting Chile, Argentina, Rio, Porto Alegre. There's one more that we did. Oh, Sao Paulo. But, you know, they usually, you know, I'll perform and I feel like, okay, I'm going to inject the energy and then bring it up. But before I could even sing, they're already like, have this, like, ah. And I'm like, oh my God. Like, you know, it made me break my kind of, I don't know, is it the third wall or the fourth wall, whatever. I kind of was just like, it pushed me out of performance mode. And I went, whoa, like, wow. And it was this kind of sharing of like, let's go, let's get it all the way up, all the way. And it was a very memorable time, and it was great. You know, I echo everything you say about Tom and his crew and the band and team. You know, it was an amazing time, great trip, and a brilliant way to see that side of the world I'd never been before. So what an experience to do it like that, man. It's great.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, like, as you were saying that, just like a nice humble flex there. Like, look at what you got to experience. It's mental.
Yeah, it's definitely... I won't forget that anytime soon, man. And, you know, the messages and the kind of like the overspill, which, you know, tends to happen of people appreciating your music and then going down their, you know, little wormhole of finding out about you and, you know, what your journey has been musically. It's been really nice, man. I've welcomed that.
Oh, cheers, man. Yeah, thank you for being on. This is very lovely and I deeply appreciate it. Thanks, man.
Yeah, no worries.
Thank you so much for checking this out. Be sure to subscribe to The New Exchange via Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you stream podcasts. Until next time, thank you for listening.